Welcome to the One Climbs Podcast, a show about exploring life through the lens of theology, scripture, symbolism, and ideas that uplift the human mind. There was an article I wrote back in December of 2013, and it was called The Struggles of Approaching Symbolic Learning. And symbolism is something I've talked about quite a bit over the past 10 years on my blog. I think the most popular articles on the blog are about symbolism, and it's something that I think a lot of people are afraid of for a variety of reasons, or they just don't feel like getting into it because they don't really see its usefulness. They think maybe, well, is this a little too out there and esoteric? What exactly would I do if I had more knowledge of symbolism? Let's take a look at this quote from David O. McKay. He says, "Do you remember when you first went through the house of the Lord? I do, and I went out disappointed. Just a young man out of college, anticipating great things when I went to the temple. I was disappointed and grieved. And I have met hundreds of young men and young women since who have had that experience. I have now found out why. There are two things in every temple: mechanics to set forth certain ideals, and symbolism, what those mechanics symbolize. I saw only the mechanics when I first went through the temple. I did not see the spiritual. I did not see the symbolism of spirituality. I was blind to the great lesson of purity behind the mechanics. I did not hear the message of the Lord. How many of us young men saw that? We thought we were big enough and with intelligence sufficient to criticize the mechanics of it, and we were blind to the symbolism, the message of the Spirit, and then that great ordinance, the endowment. The whole thing is simple in the mechanical part of it, but sublime and eternal in its significance." And so why, after a century and a half, are we not better at preparing people for these ordinances and these rituals, ceremonies? Is there a deficit in our teaching? Or is this almost sink or swim type challenge the way it's intended to be? And now, personally, I've seen the difference between people that are prepared and people that haven't really been prepared. And there's really a night and day difference. There are certain things that I've tried to do to help people be better prepared to experience the temple. And many of these things are pretty simple. Now, there are temple preparation classes that people go to, but I think often those can sometimes be either insufficient. I think a lot of it depends on the teacher and the people there and how they're preparing people. But I seem to feel, on the whole, that we do really poorly as a people in just understanding symbolism. Not just as a people, really all of Western culture, it seems, has an issue with this. So there's a man named David Littlefield. And to be honest, I don't really know much about this guy other than I've read a couple of his books that he's made available for free online. So let me read a couple of portions from his book called Mormon Mysticism. Now pay close attention to this, because I think this is really key. He says, "The average modern Mormon, like most men, is a product of his environment and the determination and abilities of his soul. The modern day American Mormon exists or has come to be what he is depending upon how he responds to the physical, intellectual, emotional, cultural, societal, economic, family, church, and the spiritual influences he is presented with. Americans think in a mostly one-dimensional, logic, and linear way. We don't process hieroglyphics well. We do process algebra well because we can move through a problem in a logical way. We have verities or things that don't change. We can hang our hat on them. Then we have variables. They change, but the change is a calculation of hard facts. Those new to the gospel can choke on the smallest of parables. The insincere wish to consume gospel principles upon their lust. They demand immediate and precise answers that require no thought or meditation. They are impatient and demanding, constantly attempting to bend eternity to their narrow views. The sincere seeker of eternal truth accepts all truth that eternity is willing to give at this moment and prepares himself for further insight, seeking to expand his spirit, free his mind, and conform his spirit to God. We need to understand symbols, types, archetypes, metaphors, motifs, and specifics. Freeing our minds from the traditions of our fathers is critical. As true Latter-day Saints, we are not required to believe anything that is not true. We must learn to not defend our small image or explanation of things against the volumes of truth that are trying to pour themselves into us. We understand things through filters of prejudice and pride. To the degree that we are able to set aside our pride and see through our prejudices, we're able to receive truth. Okay, that was kind of a long quote. Wow, and there's a lot to unpack there. There's a lot of different things. So let me go back over this real quick. So we realize that he says the average modern Mormon, but let's expand that to include anyone who comes from a Judeo-Christian background where that kind of extends out of the Western thought process, this one-dimensional logical or linear process that David is talking about. He says, we don't process hieroglyphics well. And I think there's a lot of reasons why. When you look at our language, Eastern languages have little pictures that represent letters of their alphabet or entire words and ideas. And there's deep meaning in how those characters are placed together and the numerical qualities of some of those things. Those are taken into consideration as well. So you have a very rich, intricate language that's multi-layered. But we don't really have a lot of that. We do see a lot of that kind of abstractness in art and poetry, where multiple layers of meanings can exist simultaneously. I think that's the only way we really approach it. But then we don't really maybe consider that in our daily life, or unfortunately, maybe not even how in our searching of the scriptures. We don't factor that in. We understand there's symbolism, but I don't think we really comprehend how deeply intertwined symbolism and those types of meanings are embedded within the scriptures. And I think a big portion of that is because we're reading them in English. So we don't have the original translation of the Book of Mormon in Hebrew, and we don't have the access to some of the Hebrew and Greek writings of the Old and New Testament, because at least in the United States, most people here, they don't speak Hebrew or Greek. And so they don't have access to that original language. So we're reading translations of those, or in some cases, translations of translations in the King James Version of the Bible. And so we're just not raised with that type of thought process. So when we try to switch over to this other mode, it can be very difficult for us. And there is a need to get immediate and precise answers, because we try to approach scriptures, I think, sometimes as a math problem. We want to know, okay, where does it say this? And we get one particular verse. We're like, okay, this verse answers all of the questions, instead of analyzing an entire sermon, which covers so many multi-layered and intricate things that all kind of inform all the different principles and whatnot. And we boil it down to one simple thing. I see that done a lot with, there's a verse in Alma 32 where they use it as like a definition of faith, which, and all it says is faith is not to have a perfect knowledge of things. So it's like, oh, that's what faith is. It's not to have a perfect knowledge of things. Like, well, that's not what faith is. That's what faith isn't. What is faith? You have to do a little bit more research and studying to kind of unpack what exactly faith is. But there's a lot of examples of that, I think. That's called proof texting, where you take a single piece of text from a document and use that as your evidence without considering the outer context. You have a preconceived idea of what you're trying to prove, so you find a piece of text that supports that, and then you run with it. And that's really a logical fallacy. And I think in a way it's wresting the scriptures from what their intent is, just to kind of satisfy our own our own prejudices, things like that. So we got to be careful of these things. I mean, I think we all do it. I know I do and have and probably will. But I think the more that we're cognizant of what we're doing, what's actually happening, we can avoid some of these missteps and get some clarity. It's not hard to project our own cultural idiosyncrasies, paradigms, and prejudices onto ancient writers of the scriptures, where we try to take our modern understanding of things and project it backwards in time instead of listening to what they have to say. And sometimes it's hard to know what they're saying because we don't understand their culture and the frame of reference. We're just dealing with their words. And that can be hard. And it's easy to see why we trip over that. And Joseph Smith, he wrote this in what seems to be a moment of frustration. He says, "O Lord God, deliver us in thy due time from the little narrow prison, almost as it were, total darkness of paper, pen, and ink, and a crooked, broken, scattered, and imperfect language." And I really love that. It kind of sums up some of my frustrations because, I wish I could read in some of these languages and, I could probably put in some effort to doing it. And that's one of those life goals out there. It would be great. It is intimidating for me to kind of approach learning a new language. I only speak one language. And so I try to understand as best as I can. I'm not a scholar and expert on any of these things, but when you begin to study and look into them, you can understand enough to see where some of the problems are and how you could begin to work with those problems and in finding solutions. So how do we actually teach people to learn from symbolism and this type of thinking? So there are a lot of ways that we can begin to do this. There's a lot of resources that we can examine. Back on that blog post, if you go look it up, there's a page from the church. There's a document I created called Through the Veil, which is kind of a reconstruction of the temple experience purely from the scriptures and only the scriptures. And in that document and in those scriptures, we see a lot of the language that's used in the temple, and it gives you kind of a context for what you're experiencing there, that there is a scriptural background and context to those things. So I think a lot of the things people are presented to in the temple, unless you know the scriptures really well, will be very foreign to you. So I think it's helpful to understand that there's a scriptural basis for some of these things. And so that's what that document was meant to provide. There's also a YouTube video I created called Reading Temples, which is available there and on Odyssey as well, which is another video platform, based on a presentation I gave to some youth in my ward a couple of years back, kind of helping to explain some things about symbolism in a way that can be easily understood, how you can actually read a temple. Now, there's another gentleman named Tevye Washburn who wrote a book for his little brother called Dear Jeff. There's a link to it there. And it's actually pretty fantastic. So there's also LDSSymbols.com, which shows some basic archetypes, shapes, patterns, and numbers, and what some of the potential meanings are associated with them. There's also a really great book called A Beginner's Guide to Constructing the Universe, which is by David Schneider. And man, I highly, highly recommend that. If you want one resource that you could go to right now and in a single week, flip a switch in your mind to where you're able to see things a little bit differently, that could give you the fuel that you need to kind of start that journey. It's a really great book. It's something I think even teenagers would get into. It's written almost like a textbook, but it takes you through the numbers 1 through 10, showing how they exist in the mathematical, the natural world, in art, in poetry, in scripture, in religion, all of these different things. And it gets you thinking about things really differently. And I remember I've bought so many copies of that book because I've lended mine out and I never see them again. So I'll just buy another one. And I've probably contributed quite a bit to that author. I've bought multiple copies, given them to family members and friends. It's a really great book. Really, really well done. The other thing we can do is look to Nephi. So his father had this deeply symbolic dream that he described to his family, but he didn't really talk to them about meaning. He just kind of told them what the dream meant and discuss his worry for some of his sons and his joy for his wife and some of his other sons. So Laman and Lemuel struggled quite a bit with it. And Nephi, on the other hand, did something different. He wrestled with that vision of his father, and he had this intense desire to know some things for himself about it. So he turned to the Lord, and he was rewarded with a vision in which he was shown the thing that he wished to see, which was the tree, and then to understand what it meant. And that opened up into a whole vision that transposed this tree and meaning across the history of his posterity. And it's so fascinating that a single question, the desire to know one single little thing, opened up into something much more deeper and profound. And I think that says a lot about how God works with us. He wants to give us so much, and often he almost can't help himself but give us more. Even when we do that little bit that may not seem like a big deal to us, to God, it's a huge deal. That bit of faith is more powerful than we realize. And I think God doesn't wait until we realize that. He'll simply offer us the just reward. And I think that's a terrific thing about God. And I've seen that in my own experiences as well. But here's another quote from Joseph Smith. He says, "The best way to obtain truth and wisdom is not to ask from books," even though I recommended a couple of books and things. "But the best way is not to ask from books, but to go to God in prayer and to obtain divine teaching." And the core truth of that is pretty evident. I mean, if you're trying to obtain something from God, if you're trying to go on this path, yeah, there's a lot of resources out there that I think can help you, that I think can kind of open your mind to a degree to where you can work with and wrestle with some of these things, perhaps a little bit more effectively. But the way the scriptures are written, the way they're organized, and the way that God works, none of these other things are required. You know, if they were, then God would have recommended them specifically. Oh yeah, by the way, read this book by this author, this person. Kind of some of the goofy things that I'm recommending here. And I could have just summed up this whole thing by saying, pray about it. But I know that often, you know, people can be dismissive of answers that simple. It just because the way we think, we hear messages so often that because something is repeated too often, we think it doesn't have value. We think there's always got to be another way, something more complicated. It's like Naaman when he goes to the prophet to be healed from his leprosy. A servant is sent out to tell him to go wash himself 7 times in the Jordan River, and he refuses. He doesn't accept it. And his servant tells him, you know, if the servant of the Lord had asked you to do some great thing, you would have done it, right? So why not just do this simple thing and go wash in the river? And to Naaman's credit, he agrees with that, and he goes ahead and follows that counsel, and he's healed. So there's a big lesson to us in there that sometimes, yeah, we can overcomplicate things, but sometimes it's hard to know where to start. It really is. So I just provide a couple resources here, knowing that I've been on a particular journey. I've seen other people take this journey, and I'm trying to think of what are some other ways we can help bridge that gap. How can we get someone to believe in a place, like Alma said, that they can give heed to a portion of these words, that they can carve out or clear the ground to where they can begin to plant some of these seeds of faith. And that can be challenging. That can definitely be challenging. And sometimes, unfortunately, the simplest things are not enough for some people. But if you're in a position where you feel like you're ready to exercise some of that basic faith, you can take these things to the Lord and ask him to show you the way and guide you along this process. But if you're not quite there yet, or you're curious about some of these things, there are definitely other resources that you can look to. But knowing in the back of your mind, or perhaps more appropriately in the forefront of your mind, that ultimately God should be the main source of wisdom and insight, that's definitely the path that I think we want to pursue. But hopefully there's something in here that you found helpful and useful. And I wish you the best in your journey. And yeah, we'll look forward to talking to you next time.